again. This is volume 8, and it's June the 23rd, 1907. And the heading is, "The most beautiful act is the abandonment in the will of God." Now, notice the most beautiful act, that's in God's eyes. We don't see that. So Louisa said, "I was in my usual state. Blessed Jesus would not come. And I was thinking to myself about which would be the most beautiful act, the most pleasing." Now you see the meaning of most beautiful. It's the most pleasing to the Lord that might induce him to come. That is to visit her in the way she wants. I wonder, is it sorrow for one's sins or is it resignation? Now, she's been told in 6 volumes it's resignation, but you never mind. In the meantime, he came for just a little and he said to me, "Daughter, the most beautiful act, the most pleasing to me is abandonment in my will." So that's further than resignation. Okay, total abandonment. So put Romans 8:28 beside that. Abandonment to the divine will. Now, all the saints have known that. It's just that they didn't know about abandonment at the level of divine will. So this is so great that the soul would remember no more that her being exists. That means you wouldn't be all that conscious of the body and all the human stuff. Rather, everything for her is divine will. So you've really been lifted up to this high level. Even though sorrow for one's sins is good and praiseworthy, yet it doesn't destroy one's own being. Now, you see, somebody reading this who knows nothing about these writings could come to a very wrong conclusion by what I've just read. You can't destroy your own being, can you? No. What you mean is that you put aside the ego and let the divine will reign. Would you make sure you put a note in there so that you don't ever misunderstand it? It's to put aside the ego and to let the divine will reign. While abandoning oneself completely to my will destroys one's being or puts the ego in its place, okay, it makes one reacquire the divine being. So in other words, the human will has to be put aside for the divine will to take over. You're used to that by now, aren't you?
Yeah.
So beside it, I want you to put Galatians 2:20. "I no longer live, Christ lives in me." Therefore, by abandoning... if you could try and cough into a handkerchief, it would help because it'll be heard here. "Therefore, by abandoning herself in my will, the soul gives me more honour because she gives me everything I can demand of the creature." Notice everything I can demand. Once we hand over our will... Finally, there is nothing else that the Lord can ask of us. And the soul comes to reacquire that which alone she should reacquire. That is, she reacquires God. Okay, so putting aside everything that's not God, and then you reacquire God. Now, you can put that in completely different language. You'll hear it in other volumes in completely different language, and that is that You come back to the state that Adam was in before he fell, where he was in the divine will and everything was fine. Is that okay? So we have to go back and reacquire that state. Now, in other places, you'll hear him saying, this is going back to your origin, which is right. You're going back to the state that Adam was in before the fall. So she reacquires God with all the goods that God possesses. Now, all the goods that God possesses, you have to remember that Adam before the fall was completely happy, full of the gifts and graces of God. However, as long as the soul remains completely in the divine, in the will of God, she reacquires God. But as she goes out of my will, she reacquires her own being. So that's us slipping down the ladder again, okay, with all the evils of our corrupted nature. So the only place where you get all the benefits is to stay up there in the divine will. So June the 25th, 1907, whether still or walking, the soul must always remain in the divine will. So no matter whether you're asleep or awake, working or resting, you have to stay in the divine will. So Louisa says, This morning I was thinking to myself that I felt as though stopped without moving either forward or backward. And I said, Lord, I myself cannot say what I feel. But after all, I will not afflict myself, she's been told not to, whether I am behind or still or ahead, as long as I am in your will. So you can see she's already established in the divine will. But that came very slowly over the last number of volumes. Is that okay? In whatever point or in whatever way I may be, your will is always holy. And in whatever way I will be in it, it'll be fine by me. Now, she's actually said something quite important there, and that is that we mustn't waste our time asking ourselves whether we're in or out or up or down or whether we're doing well or not doing well. Just get on with it. And the more you examine yourself, the worse you are, you know, because you'll see more and more faults. And he tells us to not put our attention on that, to put our attention on him. Yeah, it's just to come back to him all the time. So in the meantime, Blessed Jesus came for a little while and told me, my daughter, courage. Do not fear if you feel stopped, but be careful to make your stops in my will. You see, it doesn't matter whether you're stopped or whether you're walking, so long as you're in the divine will. Without going out of my volition at all. I too made my stops in it, but then in the twinkling of an eye, I do more than what I would have done for years and years. So if the stop is something that God actually wants you to do, this point of rest or whatever, then you get the energy and you, as he says, you accomplish more in a moment than you would have in years. So according to the world, it seems that I have stopped. Because since it deserves to be severely chastised and I'm not doing it, it seems that I'm not in motion. Now, the Lord is showing us how the world thinks. If you're not punished immediately for something, then as far as they're concerned, either God doesn't care or he's let you off the hook. But if I take the rod in my hand, oh dear, Psalm 2:9, you will rule them with an iron rod. Okay. Psalm 110 verse 2. This is the rod. Revelation 12, 5. Still the rod. And Revelation 19, 5 is still the rod. And the scripture says you will rule them with an iron rod. And you have to realize that the scriptures are written during the Iron Age. Okay. And as far as they were concerned, iron just would not bend. You know what I mean? They couldn't break the iron. You'd have to put it into fire, in other words. So it meant that the will of God was immovable. And you'll hear this in these writings as well. The will of God is immovable. The commandments of God are immovable. What God decided in eternity was right and good is still forever right and good. And that's what's wrong with society today. They've moved. And they say we're intolerable when we say that God hasn't moved. So they expect God to change down to their level. And that's one of the reasons why they will eventually persecute the church. And the reason why they need to pull everything down to their level is to try and salve their consciences, which are getting at them, because they know very well they're doing wrong. So he says, because I'm not punishing them, it seems I'm not in motion. But if I take the rod in my hand, you will see how I will make up for all the stops. The same for you, remaining always in my will. If you see that my will wants you stopped, then stop and enjoy my will. And if you see that my will wants you to walk, then walk. But walk always in my volition, because by walking in my will, you will walk with me. Genesis 3:8, God walked with Adam in the cool of the day. Do you remember? Therefore, remain always at the order of my will, whether still or in motion, and you will always be fine. In other words, ready to do the will of God at any moment. Okay. So July the 1st, 1907. In the divine will, one forgets about sins. Now, I want to give you a very important reference. 1 John 3, 1 John 3, verses 5 to 6, where John says that anyone who is truly in God does not sin. You see, there's a total contradiction between the word God and the word sin. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter into the presence of God. So if someone is claiming to be living in union with God and you see them sinning, then they are simply lying. And it's as simple as that. So Louisa said, I was reading about a female saint who would think constantly about her sins. It makes me wonder how saintly she was, but never mind. Asking God for sorrow and forgiveness. In my interior, I was saying, Lord, what a difference between myself and this one. I who do not think about sins, and she who always thinks about them. It shows how I got it wrong. Louisa still has not grasped the enormity of the privilege given to her. In one instant, I felt a move in my interior, something like a flash of light formed in my mind, and I heard him say, silly, silly that you are. Don't you want to understand this? When in the world has my will ever produced sins and imperfections? Okay, there's your Hebrews 12:14 again. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. Okay. Leviticus 19:2, you shall be holy, for I am holy, says the Lord. And there are others as well. My will is always holy. And one who lives in my will is already sanctified. Would you ever put a ring around already sanctified? And that person enjoys, nourishes herself with, and thinks of all that my will contains. So if you're at this level of union with God, sin is, it belongs to a different planet. Okay? Now, we didn't say imperfections. We said sins, because deliberate sin and divine will, forget about it. They don't exist in the same universe. And even though she's committed sins in the past, finding herself in the beauty, in the sanctity, and in the immensity of the goods that my will contains, she forgets the ugliness of the past. Now, it's a very important thing. You see, what that other so-called saint wasn't forgetting was the past. So I want to give you a lovely scripture, Isaiah 43, verses 18 and 19, where the Lord says, forget the past, behold, I'm doing something completely new. Okay, so here's the... So she forgets the ugliness of the past and she remembers only the present, unless she goes out of my will. Then, as she would return to her own being, it's no wonder that she'd remember her sins and her miseries. So, keep well in mind, you need to underline this, keep well in mind that these thoughts of sins and of oneself cannot enter my will. Do you see that it's an absolute statement of Jesus? Mm. And if the soul feels them, it means that she's not stable and fixed within me. It means the person is still going in and out of the divine will. So you're going to get, as we go along, lots of keys to find out where I'm at in all of this. So there's one of the keys. Okay. If there's still sin in your life, you have not committed yourself to divine will. So Louisa says, finding myself in my usual state, I saw the Lord for just a little and he told me, my daughter, as much as the truth is persecuted, one cannot help recognizing it as truth. It's a very important statement for our world today. Yeah. A very important. No matter how much they'll try and change it, they actually know it's the truth. There's a wonderful statement of St. Maximilian Kolbe where he says, now I'm not actually quoting him verbatim. I'm just trying to memorize something. He said that the truth can only be denied or accepted. It cannot be destroyed. Mm. It cannot be diluted. It cannot be changed. It can only be that a person either accepts that truth or rejects it. It's very interesting because he was going into a concentration camp to die for the truth.
Yes.
Isn't it fantastic?
Yeah. Can only be accepted. What else?
Can only be accepted or rejected. It can't be changed. It can't. It, not, you can do nothing to it. The truth is there by itself. So look at it again. And I want you to put John 14:6 beside it, where Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." As much as the truth is persecuted, one cannot help recognizing it as truth. And the time comes in which that very persecuted truth is recognized and loved. Eventually, they have to come around and accept it again. In these sad times, this is early 20th century, everything is falsehood and duplicity. Do you see why they don't want the truth? Now, the 20th century is known, and Jesus also speaks about it much more clearly in higher volumes, as the age of deception. Okay? And you need to know that deception is the first horseman of the apocalypse. In other words, something looks right, but it isn't the thing. You see, it's in the 20th century, I can wear a string of pearls around my neck, but everybody knows I paid €2 for them. It only looks like pearls, but they're not pearls. Do you see what I'm saying? It's in the 20th century we got the idea of putting plastic flowers on the table. They look good, but they're not flowers. You know.
You said the 20th century was the age of deception.
Deception, deception, yeah. And in the 20th century, we came up with the idea of false love and false joy. I'll give you an idea of false joy. You go to a party and somebody says, "Well, you're very welcome," and behind your back they say, "Oh, what's she doing here?" So it's false joy. And it's totally deceptive. It's not representing the truth, you know. Whereas if they made an effort to try and make you welcome, it would be something useful, okay? So in these sad times, everything is falsehood and duplicity. And so that truth may have lordship or rule or reign, okay, man deserves to be beaten and destroyed. Now, beaten doesn't necessarily mean with a strap, okay? It means conquered, okay? So I want to give you Isaiah chapter 2, Isaiah 2, verses 9, 11, and 17. Now, in each of those verses, Isaiah says the pride of man must be brought low. So that's what Jesus means by beaten and destroyed. Because if the pride of man isn't brought low, nothing is going to be recovered. Part of these blows they themselves will bring on themselves with wars, obviously, and they will destroy one another. Others will come from me, especially for France, for there is such a great mortality to come there as to almost depopulate her. Now, that hasn't happened actually yet. But I want to give you Isaiah 46:10 for that. And you can look that one up. Isaiah 46:10. Now, why would he point to France particularly? Well, first of all, the First and Second World Wars were all going to be lodged there. Okay. But it was during the French Revolution that atheistic materialism was, thrown onto the world. It was spawned, yeah. And therefore, in the so-called Enlightenment, and therefore France is actually responsible for all that followed it, the communism and all the rest of it that followed it. She's the origin. And the awful thing is that France was the eldest daughter of the church. Yeah, so for that reason as well, there's a huge chastisement coming. Yeah, but if she's going to be almost depopulated, it's not a chastisement, it's a judgment. Yeah. So July the 4th, 1907, the soul must ruminate within her mind the truths that she has learned. In other words, we've really got to meditate on this stuff. Louisa said, "I was thinking how bad I have become, and yet the Lord doesn't correct me. He doesn't scold me. While I was thinking of this, I felt a move in my interior, telling me, "My daughter, keep walking, keep walking, keep moving. If I am goodness, mercy and sweetness, I am also justice, strength and power." They're two aspects of the same person. If I saw you go backward or commit voluntary defects, now do you see the point? He said, after the many graces that I've given to you, you would deserve to be struck by lightning, and indeed I would strike you. In other words, there's huge responsibility going with privilege. Okay? If I don't do it, you yourself can understand why. And if I do not always speak to you, ruminate constantly in your mind on the truths that I have taught you, and then enter into your interior, unite yourself with me, and I will always be with you, operating interiorly. Now, the Lord won't stop unless you stop him. So make sure you tell the Lord you're on duty all the time. So July the 10th, 1907, one begins to really live when you become a victim. Now, this is a message for Louisa. We're not victim souls, okay? As I was in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself together with my adorable Jesus. And in seeing him crowned with thorns, I removed the crown from his head, and with both hands I placed it on mine, pressing it thoroughly. Oh, how I felt the prickings penetrate into me. But I felt happy to suffer to relieve the pains of Jesus. And then I said, "My good Jesus, tell me," I love this. I think this is really funny. You have to know, if you're talking time, you need to make sure what clock you're using. Okay. "My good Jesus," she said, "tell me, is there much time left before you take me to heaven?" The answer was about 40 years. Okay. He said, "No, only a little."
Cancer.
Yeah. She said, "Your little can be 10 or 20 years. She said, "I'm already 42. She's going to die when she's 84.
God.
And he said, "That's not true. Your years only begin the moment you began to be a victim." The way the Lord looks at time is totally different to us. There's a wonderful moment in Vasula Riden, in True Life in God, I don't know if you read her stuff, where she again asked the Lord something, and he said, "Very soon." And she said, "Your clock or mine?" She had caught on rather quickly. Yeah, and on that particular occasion, he said, "Your clock." But she had caught it. Louise is only beginning to catch it. The way the Lord looks at things and the way we look at things is very different. So he said, the Lord said he only counted her years from the time she became a victim soul. Isn't that absolutely amazing? "My goodness called you, and you can say that from that time you began to really live as distinct from live. And just as I called you to live my life on the earth, in a little while I will call you to live my life in heaven. In the meantime, two pillars came out from the hands of blessed Jesus, which then became one, and which he kept leaning on my shoulders quite heavily." This is quite important. She's now getting an insight into her vocation. "And they were leaning on my shoulders quite heavily in such a way that I couldn't move from beneath them. While he was calling me, there was no one who could go to place his shoulders under those pillars. So they remained suspended in his hands while they were suspended. And while they were suspended, slaughters of every kind occurred. I understood that those pillars were the church and the world. Now go back. He kept leaning my shoulders quite heavily." The church and the world was leaning quite heavily on Louisa. Because, you see, we're only in volume 8. She still hasn't grasped fully the sheer enormity of the vocation she's been given. But you will remember the story of Francis of Assisi back in the 13th century when the church was in crisis and the Pope had a vision of a little man with his shoulder under the church. When Francis of Assisi eventually visited him and asked him to bless his little new community, he recognised this little so-and-so was the one he saw in his vision, because Francis didn't look like anything that could support the church. And here she is 750 years later, still supporting the church. It's really amazing. So putting those two together, you're looking at a very important and privileged vocation. So I understood that those two pillars were the church and the world, which had come out from his most holy hands and were held inside his holy wounds. Look where they're held. The world is there as well. They will always be there, but if good Jesus has no place on which to lean them, he will soon tire of keeping them suspended in his hands and woe. But such woes as to be horrifying, they are such and so many that I believe it's better to remain silent about it. Now, she won't always be allowed to remain silent about things. Okay. So July the 14th, 1907, we're back to the topic of love. Love is central to everything. A summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. If we're not growing in love, we're not growing in divine will. It's actually that simple, because it's the same person. God is love and divine will is the active part of the Trinity. Okay, so I gave you all these references before. I'll give them to you again. Matthew 22, verses 34 to 39. That's Jesus saying the great law of love is central to the entire Bible. John 13, 34 to 35. That's Jesus commanding us to love as he loved.
John 13,
34 to 35. John 15, 9. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. So you are to love one another. You have 1 Corinthians 13. First Corinthians 14:1, you're to want love more than anything else. And you have Ephesians 3:16-21, you're to be grounded in love, built on love, and reach the full perfection of Christ in love. Now we're going to come across this topic over and over again because it's central to the whole thing. Now in this particular piece, which is not very long, the Lord says that if you want to avoid purgatory, learn how to love quick. Does that any help? Continuing in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a while, and without thinking, I asked, Lord, yesterday I went to confession. If I had died, since confession remits sins, would you have brought me straight to heaven? And he said, this is the revelation he gives to her, and I think it's fascinating. My daughter, he said, it's true that confession remits sins. But the surest and the most certain thing to be exempt from purgatory is love. Love must be the predominant passion in the soul. Love must be her thought, her word, her movements, everything. Everything must be enveloped by this love. In this way, finding her all love, the uncreated love, that's 1 John 4:7, God is love, the uncreated love absorbs the created love within itself. In fact, purgatory does nothing but fill the voids of love that are present in the soul. And once it has filled these voids, it sends her to heaven. But if these voids are not there, it's not something that belongs to purgatory. Is that very interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So you could have legally gone to confession and legally been absolved, but the love isn't there. We just need, because it was legalism on which Jesus told the scribes and Pharisees that they were completely offending God. They were doing everything right legally, but there was no love in their hearts. Okay. So we could make exactly the same mistake. We could say, Lord, I've been to Mass every day for the last 40 years. And he'd say, but did you love? Did you love anybody there? Or did you criticize them? Did you condemn them? Did you find fault with them all? Down to purgatory you go. You didn't love them. Yeah. I know somebody who, very committed to the Lord, was stopped on her way to communion one day, and the Lord said, "Sit down, I want to talk to you." And she's in the line going up to communion, and she said, "What's wrong?" He said, "You hate someone I love." She said, "Lord, I don't hate anybody." He said, "You do." And he put a picture of a certain person in front of her eyes. And the woman said to him, "But Lord, that's only a politician."
No.
And the Lord said, "You don't hate somebody I died for. Don't receive me in communion if you are not in communion with everybody else." Is there any help? To illustrate this, I'm telling you that.
Yeah.
Now, it was the person herself who told me, and I've never forgotten it, because we give ourselves permission to hate some people. By hate, I don't like them, and I can criticise them and all the rest of it. And then we're good to other people. That's not it. His love is universal. Our love has to be universal. If that's not a challenge, you're not alive, you see. And that's why I needed to explain that, because we do have categories in our heads. And that's why I laughed when the person said, "But that's only a politician."
Yeah.
So July the 17th, 1907. The true sign to know whether one lives in the divine will. Whoops. Would you write down the little word discernment? Because not only do you get keys to understanding things, but the Lord also gives you discernment pointers. He knows that none of us have spiritual directors. And so he gives you the spiritual direction in the book. Okay? So watch out for the piece of discernment here. "Continuing in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little, and he told me, 'My daughter, the true sign to know whether the soul lives in my will,'" it's living in his will as distinct from doing acts. Is that okay? "That the soul is living in my will is that everything that happens to her, every circumstance, takes place in peace." Now, from volume one, he has told us you must never allow disturbance inside or yourself, and he has told us that divine will gives you the peace that passes all understanding. And so if that peace is there, whether you have the cross or whether you don't, that's the sign. So that's your discernment. It's peace. "Because my will is so perfect and holy that it cannot produce even the shadow of disturbance." So when we get disturbed, then the divine will is saying, "Where did you go?" So if in contrast, mortifications or bitterness, not bitterness, that's not English, she feels disturbed, she cannot say that she's inside of my will. See, living is inside. You might be visiting the divine will. If she feels resigned and also disturbed, she can say at most that she's in the shadow of my will. In fact, while being outside of it, she's free to feel her own self, but not inside. So I want to give you some scriptures for peace. Is that okay? 1 Corinthians 7:15. "We are called to peace." Just put P for peace. 2 Corinthians 1:2. "This peace comes from God the Father." Ephesians 2:14. "Jesus is our peace." Hebrews 12:14. "Be at peace with everybody." And Philippians 4:7. "The peace that passes all understanding." And it guards the heart and the mind in Christ Jesus. Is that all right? So July 19th, 1907. "Neither aridities nor temptations nor defects enter into the divine will." That needs to be underlined. "Neither aridities nor temptations nor defects enter into the divine will, because the divine will is the perfection of God. Is that okay? So what we're going to be told here is that the divine will is happiness. So if we're going through any kind of negativity, we've got to shift out of it and get back into the divine will. Is that okay? And again, you see, it's a key. It's another one of the keys to help you to know whether you're in or out. Having spoken to someone about the will of God, it had slipped from my mouth that if one was in the will of God and feels aridity, one would be at peace. Now, aridity is a dryness of soul in which you find it almost impossible to pray. So now, as I was in my usual state, Blessed Jesus corrected me, okay, telling me, "My daughter, be very careful when you speak about my will, because my will is so happy that it forms our very beatitude, while the human will is so unhappy." That's why you put the human will aside and take the divine will. "That if it could enter into ours, it would destroy our happiness and would wage war against us. Please understand, therefore, that neither aridities, nor temptations, nor defects, nor restlessness, nor coldness can enter my will." And yeah, we all go through this stuff, okay? "Because my will is light." That's 1 John 1:5, God is light. "And it contains all possible tastes. The human will is nothing but a drop of darkness and full of disgusts. So, if the soul is already inside of my will, before she enters, at the contact with my will, its light dissolved the little drop of darkness in order to be able to have it within itself." Now, let me give you that light and the drop of darkness in language you understand. "I throw my nothingness into his allness." Is that okay? Mm-hmm. "I throw my nothingness into his allness. In order to be able to..." So there's three things he's going to tell us. One is the light of the divine will dissolved the little drop of darkness in order to be able to have it within itself. Number two, its heat dissolved the coldness and the aridities. Number three, its divine tastes removed the disgusts. We don't say disgusts, the disgust. "And my happiness freed her from all unhappiness." Do you see that entering into the divine will, you've got to let this stuff go? It's like the bird taking to the air. It's got to drop all its baggage and just take to the skies. Okay. So it might help to just write at the side, "No baggage allowed." Mm-hmm. Or "No baggage allowance." Because we'd understand that one then, wouldn't we? If we just put "no baggage allowance." You have to travel light. So August the 6th, 1907, Louisa sees nothing but chastisements. "Continuing my usual state, I found myself outside of myself inside a church. And I seemed to see a most beautiful lady with her breast so full of milk that it seemed that her skin was about to split. Calling me, she said to me, 'My daughter, this is the state of the church. She is so full of interior bitterness,'" knock out the S's, "and in addition to the interior bitterness, she is about to receive external bitterness." Now, you see, 1907, we're moving towards the communist takeover in Russia and the terrible destruction of the church in Russia and its satellite states. "You should suffer a little that they be mitigated." And while saying this, she seemed to open her breasts and, forming a cup with her hand, she filled it with milk and gave it to me to drink. It was so very bitter. You see, it was not the milk that comes from Jesus, which is sweet. "And produced so many sufferings that I myself cannot explain it. In the meantime, I saw people starting a revolution." You see, they're the Marxist communists, okay? "Entering churches, stripping altars and burning them." Now, beside that, I want to put Isaiah 46:10. the Lord telling the prophets ahead of time. And making attempts on the lives of priests and breaking statues and 1,000 other insults and evils. And while they were doing this, the Lord was sending more scourges from heaven, and many were killed. There seemed to be a general uproar against the church. Well, that's a very good description of what was going on in Russia. Against the government and against one another. I was frightened. I found myself within myself, and I kept seeing the Queen Mother, together with other saints, praying to Jesus Christ that he would let me suffer. Now, notice that our Blessed Mother and the saints are not apart, sitting up on a cloud playing harps. That's the ludicrous image that somebody has given us as to what heaven is like. They're absolutely involved in what's going on down below, and they're participating. And what they're doing at this particular moment is interceding with the Lord that the victim soul would suffer to mitigate some of this stuff. That's what they're actually doing. So you see heaven very much involved in what's going on earth. And you remember St. Therese of Lisieux said before she died, I will spend my heaven in doing good upon earth. Do you remember? So they were praying to Jesus that he would let Louisa suffer. It seemed he would not pay attention to them, but they kept insisting. Now, there's your perseverance in prayer that Jesus taught in Luke 11. Okay. Importuned, Blessed Jesus answered, "Do not importune me, be quiet, otherwise I will take her with me." But in spite of this, it seemed that I suffered a little bit, so he would allow her to mitigate some of it. Now, I'm going to say altogether that during almost all of these days, as I find myself in my usual state, I see nothing but revolutions and chastisement. So she's seeing what's coming down the line. Blessed Jesus is almost always taciturn, which means he wants to do the chastisements. And every now and then he just tells me, "My daughter, do not force me, otherwise I'll take you out of this state." In other words, don't try to change my mind, and that's it. And Louisa says, "My life and my all, if you want it to be left free to do what you want, take me with you, in death understood. And then you will be able to do whatever you want." Look how quickly she has forgotten that the church and the world are all leaning on her. Isn't it amazing? We can forget the most central and obvious things. It seems that in these days it takes a great deal of patience dealing with Jesus. I love that. In other words, she's not impressed, and she cannot see that she doesn't remember what he's already told her. You know, in fact, it took an awful lot of patience on Jesus' part to put up with Louisa and all the rest of us, how much it takes. So August the 22nd, 1907. The soul must be in the world as if there was no one else but God and herself. So what you're talking about here is detachment, okay? That if we're involved in the world, the Lord really can't use us to save it. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus came for just a little, and he told me, "My daughter, in order for grace to have free access to the soul, she must be in the world as if there were no one else but God and herself, because any other thought or thing put themselves between the soul and grace, preventing grace from entering into the soul and the soul from receiving grace." Let me translate that into English. If you're spending hours watching television and on your gadgets and all the rest of it, God can't be communicating all of this stuff to you, because the world has intervened and the world is influencing your mind. And the world is influencing your heart. And that's what he's saying, that the more we want to let the Lord use us to save the world and to bring them out of that darkness, the more detached from the world we have to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Therefore, we have to make a resolution for Lent to fast from television.
Yeah.
There's nothing only junk on it anyway.
Yeah.
Another day, Jesus told me, "My daughter, the cause that renews my passion is the lack of resolution." This is the inconstancy that he has spoken about many times. that, you know, we start Lent tomorrow and we've forgotten it the following day. Not even among themselves are they so cowardly as to not keep what they promise to one another. Only with me do they reach such cowardice and ingratitude, even though they know that I suffer greatly because of it. That one hour they promise and another one they deny the promise. That's us. That's inconstancy. And throughout these writings, Jesus will say he can do nothing with a person who's on today and off tomorrow. He can do nothing with them. So September 1907, the more the soul is the same in everything, the closer she comes to divine perfection. Now, this is the constancy as distinct from the inconstancy. So we put constancy on this one. I was going through most bitter days, Louisa said, with continuous privations. At the most, he comes like a shadow and lightning and with almost continuous threats of chastisements. Oh, God, what an uproar, she said. It seems that the world is shaken. All are in the attitude of making revolutions and of killing each other. The Lord seems to withdraw his grace. Now, that is the worst punishment of all. You see, you know from volume one that he said, I am grace. Sorry, it's volume two. I am grace, he said. So that means the Lord withdraws. Well, put beside that Romans chapter 1. Okay. And in Romans chapter 1, St. Paul describes the terrible filth of Rome in his own day and says three times during that chapter that the Lord abandoned them. He abandoned them to their filthy practices. He abandoned them to idolatries. He abandoned them to their worldliness and so on. That's the worst punishment of all. Of course, Rome was conquered not long after that. And the other example I've given you several times is Ezekiel chapters 10 and 11. In chapter 10, the Lord rose up from the temple and hovered over the temple because it was his own house. But he wasn't going to stay with all the sinfulness that was there, and he left. But on that occasion, the people repented and he came back in chapter 11. Okay. So the big lesson there is that he will go away if we drive him away with sin, but he will return if we repent, both individually and collectively. But this sentence says that when the Lord withdraws his grace, human beings become like fierce animals. Now, if you've examined the stuff that went on in the concentration camps in the Second World War, yeah, they did act like animals.
Yeah.
And they reduced human beings in the most unbelievable way. But after all, it's better to keep silent about these things because talking about it embitters my poor soul too much, which is already full of bitterness. Then this morning, Blessed Jesus came for just a little and told me, all the works of God are perfect. Now, the word perfect means complete. There's nothing missing. And their perfection is recognized by their, this is fascinating to me, by their being round or square. Okay, so much so that not a stone is placed in the celestial Jerusalem which is not round or square. Now, the celestial Jerusalem is described in Revelation 21 and 22. Louisa said, I couldn't understand anything of this. I don't blame you. However, as I went about looking at the vault of the heavens, I could see that the stars and the sun and the moon, they were all in the shape of being round. But I couldn't understand the meaning of it. And the Lord said, roundness means that it is the same from all parts. Like if you take a wheel, that it's the same distance from the center. It's complete. It's not out of shape and it's fatter on one side and thinner on another. So roundness is the same in all parts. So in order to be perfect, the soul must be the same in all states. Now, we even use the expression that someone is well-rounded, don't we? And we don't realise what we're saying, do we? So in all states, now that means whether you are in aridity or in happiness or whatever it is, okay? Whether prosperous or adverse, whether sweet or bitter. Equality must surround her in everything. So you, the equality is part of this being the same all round, in such a way as to shape her like a round object. Otherwise, she's not equal to herself in all things. She will not be able to enter beautiful and smooth into the celestial Jerusalem. In other words, you see, we're the living stones in the temple of God. You remember? Mm-hmm. So I want to give you a few scriptures there. 2 Corinthians 6:16. Ephesians 2:19-22. And 1 Peter 2:4-5. We're the living stones. So all these stones have to be round and well rounded.
1 Peter 2:4-5.
Otherwise, she won't be able to enter beautiful and smooth into the celestial Jerusalem, and will not be able to adorn like a star the fatherland of the blessed. Now, as we go on in these writings, the Lord is going to tell us that inside of us, there is a universe like you see outside. And so there's sun, moon, stars, planets and all the rest of it. I don't understand what I'm talking about, but this is what he says. But I do know that back in the 1960s, when I asked a professor to give a lecture to the first year students, science students, who had given up going to church after a week of being in a university because they were now scientists, you know. And I said, would you ever tell these so-and-sos that they know nothing? And the professor was a Jesuit, and he gave the most incredible talk. It's one of the few talks I've been really sorry we had no gadgets to record. That we weren't recording anything back in the 60s. And he said, I want to start, he said, by telling you that the structure of the cell in your body, any cell in your body, he said, is the same as the structure of the universe out there. It has a centerpiece we call the nucleus. It has other little planets going around it. And he said, you've got the sun out there and you've got the planets going around it. He said, it's exactly the same structure. Now, I'm just giving it to you very quickly because I don't want to spend my time on this. And as you go on in these writings, the Lord is going to say that there are suns, moons, planets inside of us as well. I don't understand that, but I do understand that the structure of the cell is the same as the structure of the universe. So what is outside of you is inside of you, and what's inside of you is outside of you. It's a great mystery that maybe eventually somebody will get, and then I will listen, hopefully, to understand. But I do know that up in one of the higher volumes, that the Lord is talking about people who barely make it to salvation by the skin of their teeth. And the example he gives to me was awesome. You know, around the earth, you have all of these rocks spinning around, doing nothing really, and they could crash into the earth and create terrible problems. He said, the people who barely make it by the skin of their teeth, he said, will be the dust floating around in the universe. They won't be my stars, and they won't be my planets. They won't be my galaxies. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow. But they'll be there.
But there won't be any consequence.
Yeah, and you see, here it's they don't have this wonderful roundness. They don't have this completeness. Yeah. They don't have even the right shape. Yeah. You know, it's fascinating. So if you just look at the next sentence, they'll not be able to adorn like a star the fatherland of the blessed. So the more the soul is the same all around, that is well-rounded, okay, the closer she comes to divine perfection. Now, we're told that the divine will is a single point. Now, a single point is well-rounded.
Yeah.
It's not square.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So, October the 3rd, there's an awful lot more you could say about that, but I'll leave that to you. So, don't you realise that that's another key that's been given to you? We have to be well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let me sort of try and give you some kind of an example that might be useful. I don't know whether it will or not. And that is that you have to have the correct amount of patience and kindness and all the fruits of the Spirit. They must all be well-rounded in you. You can't have have one virtue and then there's this big gap. You can't have that. You've got to have an equal amount of all of them. The whole thing as well. You see the whole list of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians 5:20. You have to be well-rounded in them all. But then you see in the teaching on love in Louisa's writings, the Lord says that the one thing that gives you the greatest perfection is love. And it brings all the others to perfection. Okay. So we're going to get another key in October 3rd, 1907. How one's own self renders God a slave. It's another key to know whether I'm in or out or halfway in or halfway out. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, blessed Jesus wouldn't come. And I was tormented by the pain of his privation. And not only by this, but by the thought that my state of victim might no longer be the will of God. She goes through this many times. I seem to have become nauseating before the Lord, worthy only of being abhorred. Then, while I was thinking of this, he came for just a little and he said, my daughter, one who chooses his own self, even for one instant, represses grace. Now, will you write beside it, God is grace. Okay. Even for one instant, isn't that incredible? He becomes the master of himself and renders God a slave. Why does God become a slave? Because you can't live without the divine will concurring with your life, with everything. Okay? And he added, the will of God makes one take the divine possession, but the obedience is the key to open the door and enter this possession. So that's for us the Ten Commandments, the teaching of the church, the scriptures and so on, the key to obedience. Okay. So having said this, he disappeared. So there's the warning that even if we go out for a moment, we're doing terrible damage. You see, you couldn't say this to someone who wasn't living in the divine will because it would mean nothing to them. Yeah. So October the 4th, this is another very important one, the exaltation of the cross. The cross grafts divinity to humanity. This is why the cross has to be given to us. Continuing in my usual state of privation, and therefore with little suffering, I was saying to myself, not only of Jesus am I deprived, but also of the good of suffering. This has been taken away from me. She said, oh God, you want to put me to fire and to sword and touch the things which are most dear to me and which form my very life, Jesus and the cross. If I am abominable to Jesus because of my ingratitude, he's right in not coming. But you, O cross, what have I done to you that you have left me barbarously, she says. Did I perhaps not welcome you when you came? Did I not treat you as my faithful companion? I remember that I loved you so much that I could not be without you. And sometimes I even preferred you to Jesus. I didn't know what you had done to me and I could not be without you. Yet you left me. It's true that you have done much good to me. You were the way, the door, the room, the secret, the light in which I could find Jesus. Look at that. Isn't that list is incredible. Okay. And this is why I loved you so much. But now everything's over for me. She's very good at saying that. While I was thinking of this, blessed Jesus came for just a little and told me, daughter, the cross is part of one's life. And only one who does not love his own life does not love the cross. That's most of us, isn't it? Only one who does not love his own life does not love the cross, because It was the with the cross alone that I grafted the divinity to lost humanity. Only the cross continues redemption in the world, grafting anyone who receives it into my divinity. And if one does not love it, it means he knows nothing about virtues, perfection, the love of God, or of true life. For example, a rich man who has lost his riches and is presented with the means to reacquire them again, maybe even more. How much does he not love this means? Does he perhaps not put his own life into this means in order to find again the riches, such as the cross? Man had become so very poor, that is spiritually, and the cross is the means not only to save him from misery, but to enrich him with all goods. Therefore, the cross is the richness of the soul. And he disappeared while I remained more embittered, thinking of what I had lost. So I want to give you references to the cross. Matthew 10:38. Matthew 16:24. Galatians 6:14 and Hebrews 12:2. Now there will be lots more as well. So October the 12th, 1907, she sees places devastated because of justice. After going through days of privation and of tears, finally this morning Jesus came and told me, "Ah, my daughter, you know nothing of what is supposed to happen between now and 1 year from now." Okay? Oh, how many things will happen. We do know that in 1908 that a meteor struck in Russia. Do you remember? And it gave a few people a fright because it devastated an entire area. It was just the mercy of God that it hit a place that wasn't...
A very remote area.
Yeah. Siberia. Yeah, it wasn't lived in. But they learned an awful lot about meteors hitting the earth by looking at the devastation that it did. So he said, from now to 1 year to now. At that moment, she said, I found myself outside of myself, that's in an out-of-the-body experience, together with Jesus. So again, I want to give you Amos 3:7. Amos 3:7. And Isaiah 46:10. The Lord always tells the prophets first. And this time she says, somewhere I saw places collapsed and entire towns buried. Somewhere I saw places flooded and everything that existed in them disappeared. In other places I saw earthquakes and great damage, and I saw dead people. I saw revolutions in several places, and in some of them so violent that one could not take a step without treading on human blood. But who can say all the tragedy that could be seen? After this, good Jesus added, have you seen? Ah, my daughter, courage, patience. Patience in the state in which you are. Since justice wants to pour itself out on creatures, it refrains from pouring itself out on you. The void of your sufferings will fill the void of their sufferings. Now here he's explaining the privations in a way she hasn't heard before. So what he's saying is, Louisa, if you suffer, humanity is spared in part. If you don't suffer, humanity has to get the chastisement. One or the other is going to suffer. So let us give course to justice a little bit, he said. It is actually necessary. Creatures are growing too bold. So there you have your Isaiah 2 thing again. Just put Isaiah chapter 2, that the pride of man needs to be brought low. Then everything will end and I will be with you as before. Now he doesn't say that he's probably telling her about two world wars, you know, and she will die after the second one. You know, he's too wise to tell us stuff. So October the 29th, 1907, True Love and Sacrifice. So we're back to love again, only we've added the element of sacrifice. As I was in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself and I saw baby Jesus, who, placing himself on my bed, beat my whole body with his hands, also giving me some kicks. It's a rather interesting image, isn't it? After he beat me well, he trampled on me. Then he disappeared. And as I returned to myself, I couldn't understand the reason for this beating. But I was content. That's something else, isn't it? Remembering that I had drawn closer to Jesus to be beaten more. Then, while feeling all beaten up, I was surprised again by blessed Jesus, who, removing the crown of thorns, obviously he's not a child now, from his head, drove it into mine, but with such force that all the thorns were driven into me. Then, placing himself in my interior, almost in the act of moving forward, he said, "My daughter, how are you doing?"
So she couldn't.
Let us go higher, he said. Let us go higher in chastising the world. It's very interesting now how he's challenging her. Now, first of all, he has satisfied her and said, "You want to be beaten up, you get beaten up. You want to carry the crown of thorns, you get the crown of thorns." Now he said, "Any chance that we could go higher and that you could actually correspond with what the divine will needs to do? The divine will knows the correct thing to do." And you see, Louisa is gradually being pulled away from the position she was in as a victim soul into someone who is going to be given this completely new revelation for the world. And she will have to leave all of this suffering to go into this higher position for the Lord. So that's what he's saying, let's go higher, let's go higher. She said, "I felt frightened." She wasn't frightened by the crown of thorns. I would have been finished, I don't know about you. "I felt frightened on hearing that I was uniting my will to his in going higher with chastisements." And he added, "That which I tell you, you must not forget." Now, she does forget things. "Remember that some time ago I showed you the present chastisements as well as those which I was to send in the future. And you, presenting yourself before my justice, pleaded so much for mankind, offering yourself to suffer anything that was conceded to you as alms, that instead of doing 10, out of regard for you, it would do 5. Do you remember Abraham? Genesis 18, verses 16 to 23. He was interceding for Sodom and Gomorrah. And he asked, would it be saved for 50? And then he realized, no, there isn't 50 there. And he went down and he went down and he went down. He actually went down to 5. So there wasn't even one decent one there, because Lot and his family weren't decent, were they? They were saved for his sake. So when Louise is being told that she would get 50% reduction, that's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible.
It is absolutely incredible. She has no idea of the effect she's having. This is why this morning I beat you, to be able to give you your intent. And then, as though having to do 10, I do 5. So he says, half the chastisements were not given because of you. Isn't that absolutely incredible?
Amazing, amazing.
Yeah. So then he goes on to explain how love and sacrifice work together as a very powerful offering to God. So I'll finish with this one, but it's very special. I didn't want to finish before this. And then he added, "My daughter, love is that which ennobles the soul and gives her possession of my riches." So here again, we're back to this absolutely central point, but with the addition of sacrifice. "Love is that which ennobles the soul and gives her possession of all my riches, because true love tolerates no division of any kind, even though one may be inferior to the other." So that's your John 14, verses 20 to 21, "You in me and I in you." So what is mine is yours in this oneness. This is the language of two beings who really love each other, because true love is transformation. So the beauty of one removes the ugliness of the other, and renders him beautiful. If one is poor, I make him rich. If he is ignorant, I make him learned. If he is wretched, I make him noble. The heartbeat, the breath, the will, and the two beings that love each other is one. I try to make English out of that. Is that okay? And if any other heartbeat or breath wanted to enter into them, they feel suffocated, breathless and torn, and they become ill. So, true love is health and sanctity, and one breathes a balsamic and fragrant air, which is the breath and the life of love itself. But it is in sacrifice that this love is more ennobled, more strengthened, more confirmed, and more expanded. Now, parents know about this. You welcome a child into your house on its first day, and you're giving yourself in sacrifice for the rest of your life. Am I correct?
Yeah.
And you are making decisions and sacrifices you wouldn't have dreamt of making if this tiny prince or princess hadn't taken over your life. They walk in and they take over, isn't that it? And they learn how to play the one off the other before they can even sit up. So the love that keeps family going is sacrificial love. It's sacrificial love. And that's one of the glories of family life, that the Lord brings you into sacrificial love without even discussing it. You discover this is the way it has to be. And you'll discover after the birth of the child that you used to sleep every night 8 hours. You weren't called in the middle of the night. So it's in sacrifice that this love is more ennobled, more strengthened, more confirmed and expanded. So notice it's the sacrifice that gives the love this extra push. So love is flame and sacrifice is the wood. Where there's more wood, the flames reach higher and the fire is always greater. In other words, love has to be fed by sacrifice. And this is what we do during Lent. We tell the Lord we love him, but in Lent you're asked to add the addition of sacrifice. So what is sacrifice? It is to empty oneself out in the love and in the being of the beloved. And the more one sacrifices himself, the more he is consumed in the being of the beloved, losing his own and acquiring all the features of the nobility of the divine being. Because divine love is completely sacrificial towards us. C, it is so also in the natural world, though very imperfect. Who acquires a name, a nobility and heroism? Number one, it's the soldier who sacrifices himself, who exposes himself in battle, who lays down his life for love of the king. Or is it another person who stands akimbo? Akimbo means idle. I had to look that one up. So it's the same with the servant. This is the second example. Who can hope to sit at the table of his master? It's the faithful servant who sacrifices himself, who lays down his life, who has greater care for the interests of his master than for his own, out of love for his master. Or is it the servant who, though he fulfills his duty, when he can shun a sacrifice, shuns it? Certainly it's the first one. The next example, number three, is a son with his father. The next one is a friend for his friend. And so with all the rest. I'm amazed he didn't say a parent with a child. Therefore, love ennobles and unites, and it forms one single thing, because love is unity. And it goes out to give life to the other, and the other responds by giving life back. Sacrifice is the wood that makes the fire of love grow. Obedience then orders everything. So it's love, sacrifice and obedience. Now, why don't you write on the top of your page or whatever, keys? Because we're getting keys for understanding the way to enter into the fullness of divine will. So we leave it there. tonight.